Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Biography. I'm Mark Klobis, your host for the channel. Today, I'm talking with Albert Gurganus about his account of the life of the German journalist and politician Kurt Eisner, entitled Kurt Eisner, A Modern Life. Al, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Mark, and thanks to New Books Network.
Oh, it's our pleasure. I wonder if you could start us off by telling us something about yourself.
I am Professor Emeritus of Modern Languages at the Citadel, the Military College of South Carolina. I currently reside in my hometown of Raleigh, North Carolina.
What was it that led you to write a biography of Kurt Eisner?
In 1976-77, I was studying modern European history for a master's degree at the University of Chicago. And I was reading propaganda pertaining to the Hottentot elections of 1907. And I read some pieces by Kurt Eisner that captivated me. And after that, I tried to read everything by Eisner I could lay my hands on. So eventually, I gravitated back to literature at the University of North Carolina, and I continued to be interested in Eisner and projected a master's thesis there on his didactic fiction, and then continued that for my doctorate.
As you described just there, he really did have quite a range of writing, journalism, plays, and so forth. And yet I was surprised to find that there wasn't really a major biography of him until you sat down to write one. What was it that led you to undertake such a formidable task, and what were some of the challenges involved?
There have been several works in German. There is one work from 1965 by the American Alan Mitchell, where Eisner's period of government was treated. And I thought this really is a fascinating figure who merits a proper life.
And yet, it's interesting, to, as you detail in the book, what you had to go through to get to it, how the degree to which the papers really haven't become available in quantity until within just the past couple of decades.
Exactly. Initially, there was virtually no access for Western scholars to the Institute for Marxism-Leninism in Berlin. And then at the fall of the wall in Berlin, for the first time we did have access. And I was one of the first 40 folks who were allowed in. And I was stunned at the richness of that collection. Eisner's personal papers, his manuscripts, and began working on it then at the old IML, Institute for Marxism-Leninism. That collection was eventually subsumed into the Bundesarchiv in Berlin, and I made a number of trips there to sort through those papers over a period of years. Then in Munich, there is also a repository of Eisner's government papers. And then there were papers of his correspondence at Koblenz at the Bundesarchiv, and also at the archive in Amsterdam. In Berlin, Koblenz, Munich, Amsterdam, New York, the Leo Baeck Institute, his papers have become fairly far flung. So that necessitated some grants, some travel, and a lot of work reading until your eyes bleed.
I think that there are quite a few people who could relate to that experience. I wonder if you could start us off in terms of talking about Eisner, as to talk a bit about his background, because as you explain in the book, he has this background, which given what he eventually becomes and the politics he adopts, is a little surprising.
Yes, it is. He, I think of him in 1918, when he leads the Bavarian Revolution and establishes the Republic, you know, as a pariah come to power. He was the son of a Jewish immigre from Bohemia to Berlin. His father, Emanuel Eisner, through much diligence, hard work, became a purveyor to the court in military regalia. This was a Jewish family, bourgeois family, with close ties to the court. Eisner received an elite education at the Askanisches Gymnasium in Berlin, one of the elite preparatory schools, and then had the opportunity to attend Berlin University. He was in preparation for an academic career, good solid bourgeois background, and then he began to shift from the study of literature to the study of philosophy. And it was that study that led him to Kant, and he spent several years of his life really poring over Kant, continuing that study eventually in Marburg under Hermann Cohen, one of the key figures in the neo-Kantian school. And so Eisner was not a traditional Orthodox Marxist. His thinking was very much tinged by Kantian ethics.
I was thinking about the intellectual journey that you described, and I was, and it brings to mind also in terms of his academic development, how many of his friends later in life, even after he embraces this career as a journalist and as later on as a politician, they still saw him very much as an academic. And they had talked, you mentioned how when he's arrested for the first time, he's described as a part-time lecturer and as a doctor. And yet, as you explain, he never actually takes that degree. Why doesn't he?
This has to do with his split from his parents. He at university fell in love with the daughter of a painter, Lisbeth Hendrich. She was from a Protestant home. He was determined to wed her, and this led to a rupture in his relationship with his parents for several years. And at the time he determined to wed Lisbeth Hendrich, he decided he had to go his own way. And for that reason, withdrew from university after having worked for a long time on a dissertation on the romantic Achim von Arnim, and went to work for the Herald News Agency. This was his gateway into journalism. He worked at the Frankfurter Zeitung in Frankfurt am Main, and then was at Marburg for the General Anzeiger, which became the Hessische Landeszeitung. And it was here that he really made the acquaintance of Hermann Cohen and those men associated with Cohen at Marburg.
I was wondering if you could perhaps give us a bit of background here and explain a bit about the sort of newspapers he was working for, the nature of journalism at that time, and the sort of journalism that Eisner himself engaged in.
Well, when he began at the Herald News Agency, he was collecting news for this syndicated agency. And had the honor of being one of the very few journalists who accompanied Bismarck after his resignation back to his home. Eisner sat in the train compartment with Bismarck, interviewed him, wrote that up, and then saw it changed to purpose by various newspapers, and started really to understand, how journalism functioned at the time. He he began to realize that newspapers were conglomerates that represented business interests in many cases. That was certainly the case at the Frankfurter Zeitung, which was a liberal democratic paper. At this time, that did fit his politics. But he initially at Frankfurt, he was doing things like copy reading advertisements for cigar shops and the like. At the same time he was working for the paper in Frankfurt, he was also pursuing his own freelance career. He had become extremely interested in philosophy and was really the first person to present a comprehensive scholarly study of Nietzsche. This was his book, Psychopathia Spiritualis, which was published initially in serial form in the journal Gesellschaft, and then printed as a book shortly thereafter, and really in many ways set his course. He was at that point, I think, still interested in an academic career. But once he left Frankfurt and went to Marburg and began formal study under Hermann Cohen, he was increasingly aware of the political divides in Germany. The neo-Kantians are associated with evolutionary socialism. And that is certainly where I believe Eisner was tending at that point in his career, right up until his arrest. He was not affiliated formally with the German Social Democratic Party while he was working in Marburg, although he had a good relationship with Philipp Scheidemann, who became then during the First World War and Weimar Republic a linchpin socialist. Social Democrat, majority Social Democrat, and Eisner was recruited by Scheidemann to join the party, but resisted, and then it came his arrest for lèse-majesté, where he in an anonymous article. Wrote a piece that was offensive to the Kaiser. He was ferreted out, arrested, and then served a 9-month prison term for that offense.
That imprisonment helps to illustrate the environment in which he worked, and you do a great job in the book of explaining that environment about how this is not a free press as we would understand it in the 21st century. This is one in which they're being constantly monitored by the police. As you're describing, you have the problem of lèse-majesté, but you also have political considerations. And this is a time when the Social Democratic Party is not a organization that has a dominant presence in German politics. They are a party that often faces a degree of arrest and monitoring by the police. And yet it was in this environment that Eisner really gets his journalistic feet wet, his political feet wet, and becomes not just a public intellectual, but a journalistic activist, as you describe in these articles, where he's not just reporting news, but he's seeking to try to influence opinion towards what becomes the Social Democrats.
Yes, thank you for your compliment, by the way. The Social Democrats under Bismarck were indeed outlawed and exiled. They continued to function as a party for the most part out of Switzerland. They had an illegal newspaper that was smuggled into Germany. And when Eisner really finishes his schooling and begins to write. The Social Democrats are feeling their way back into the political mainstream. Eisner at Marburg participated in political campaigns against the anti-Semitic party. And I think that this is really his entree into political activism, going out campaigning with one of his colleagues who was challenging a prominent anti-Semite. And this is why Philipp Scheidemann and Wilhelm Liebknecht, who at the time was editor of Vorwärts, the Social Democratic Party organ in Berlin, why they became attracted to Eisner and tried to recruit him. The writing for which he went to jail was for a Berlin journal called Die Kritik. And so he tried to keep that a bit separate from his career track, but it did catch up with him. And it turned out that it became a major impetus to his shift in career when he left jail and was recruited directly by Wilhelm Liebknecht, who came to Marburg to speak with him. Eisner then joined the Social Democratic Party and became Liebknecht's right-hand man at Vorwärts and the heir apparent. That's a remarkable turn of events. Philipp Scheidemann was immensely surprised because up until that point, Scheidemann remarked that Eisner had no interest in class struggle.
As Scheidemann is changing, he brings in Eisner, who himself is also evolving as a figure. But you also described that in addition to him rising up in terms of the leadership of the of Vorwärts, he also is very well compensated for his journalism more generally, which I read as something that spoke to the quality of his work and the esteem of it. Was that an accurate reading?
That is very accurate. He was well paid for what he did, and eventually, when he was working even under as an associate editor at Münchner Post, later in his career, he was receiving more compensation than say Karl Kautsky, who was editor of Neue Zeit in Berlin. The theoretical publication of the Social Democratic Party. And so if you look at Eisner's demand as a political commentator, as a literary critic, as a drama critic, he never went without work. And whether he was writing for bourgeois papers, socialist papers, journals, he always did well enough that he could support his family quite well.
And as you describe, his family was a fairly substantial one. He and his wife have several children. He mm-hmm. is also supporting his parents to a degree. It really gives you a sense as to just how successful he is, even though his politics are in many ways still seen by most Germans as outside the mainstream.
You know, Alan Mitchell, in his study of Eisner's government, talks about Eisner's early career and says that had he not been writing for the political press, he might well have earned his living as a cabaret writer, because he was quite witty. He could be coruscating in the same manner as Kurt Tucholsky.
How does he eventually become the editor of Vorwärts, and what does he do for that newspaper during his time as editor?
Under Wilhelm Liebknecht, who was aged at this point, Eisner was serving as the managing editor, under an editor in chief. And Liebknecht had that status because of his history in the founding of the party, his close association with Babel, the chairman of the party. And Liebknecht could do virtually anything he liked in that position as editor-in-chief. Eisner, as his managing editor, his assistant, once Liebknecht died suddenly, and Eisner advanced to the position of chief editor, but not editor-in-chief, he was more limited. And at the at that exact time, there was there was the beginning of the schism in German social democracy, where you had a radical left wing, you had a mainstream, and then you had the reformists, who were the right wing of the Social Democratic Party. Eisner was presiding at that point over over an editorial staff that was fairly equally balanced between the left wing, the right wing. Eisner tried to maintain a centrist position, and to balance out the discord, and that eventually became the reason for his downfall as editor in chief, because he would not throw his influence to one side or the other, believing that as the head editor of the Social Democratic Party organ, it fell to him to be unbiased and to allow a free exchange of opinion in the pages of that organ.
Was his position a factor in why Vorwärts was so successful during his tenure as editor, or and what were some of the other reasons why he was regarded so well by his peers?
Absolutely, he immensely improved the style of the journal. Subscriptions increased substantially, almost doubling during his first few years. So when he was being criticized, he could always point to, well, we're selling more papers than we have. We're bringing in a left liberal audience. Folks are reading our newspaper. Precisely because of the theater reviews, which was almost unheard of in a social democratic paper at the time, one of the controversies aesthetically at that time was that of naturalism, and what role naturalism as a literary movement played in the life of a political party. And quite a bit of debate in the German Social Democratic Party about was there a socialist art, and Eisner was a leading figure in that. You also had the Volksbühne movement, the Free Stage movement. Eisner was a charter member of the Free Stage in Berlin. He advocated performances of Ibsen, eventually of Strindberg. And actually was able to shape the German theater movement to a great degree because of that. His sense of style elevated the quality of Vorwärts, and of course he was criticized by some elements in the party for his aestheticism. Which conflicted with what they considered to be scientific socialism.
What you've described is the intellectual range of Eisner's writings and his engagement. But as you mentioned earlier, he was also engaged with the practical politics of Wilhelmine Germany. He's writing about the issues of his day. He is writing about he's providing electioneering for the elections that are taking place. What positions is he taking there, and to what degree and in what ways is he helping the Social Democratic Party in the early 20th century?
As editor of Vorwärts, it fell to Eisner to attend and to comment on the annual party congress. And as these debates raged between the left of the party and the radicals and the reformists on the right, Eisner commented on the debate. He tried to inform that debate, and he then presented on the front page of the party organ every day of the party congress and for some weeks afterward, an editorial on the upshot of those debates. So he, in this case, he was really defending the party against its critics in the conservative segment, in the bourgeois liberal segment, but also trying to keep the party from splintering, which it eventually did. And this is, of course, the subject of Karl Schorske's book, The Great Schism. And Eisner was in large part caught up in that. But you know, as editor of the party organ, which Lenin considered to be the great party organ of the great socialist party of Europe at that time, you know, Eisner's job was to, as he viewed it, was to maintain the party structure to prevent the fragmentation into divisions that that ultimately he could not prevent.
So it sounds like, you know, given what you described, that he was perhaps disappointed by the event, by the fact that he couldn't prevent it, and that he was eventually deprived of his editorship. What did he do after he left Vorwärts?
Well, he was caught up really in a purge at Vorwärts, where the party radicals increasingly gained strength. And when I say party radicals, I'm talking here, this is Rosa Luxemburg. This is, she is assisted here by Franz Mehring and by Karl Kautsky. They had Babel's ear. Babel was concerned that the revisionists, the reformists, whose leader was Edward Bernstein, were gaining too much power in the party. They moved to check that. They attempted to realign the balance of the editorial staff of Vorwärts. Some editors were dismissed. Some were reassigned. Eisner, in protest, tendered his resignation, and it was accepted. This was in, he had been there since 1898. He left Vorwärts in 1905, and for a year or so, there was a period in the wilderness where he was a freelance writer. He began writing for Heinrich Braun's journal, Neue Gesellschaft, New Society, and he cast about to recreate himself and to really to reconsolidate alliances that he might eventually return to an editorship, which he did in Nuremberg at the Frankische Tagespost, the Franconian daily, the party organ there of Nuremberg in North Bavaria, but this was a time where I think Eisner really began to realize who his true friends were, and that was in many respects beneficial. He was targeted by Josef Bloch, the editor of Sozialistische Monatshefte, the Socialist Monthly. Bloch really wanted Eisner to come to work for that journal, a very influential journal. But it it also represented the reformist view to a point that Eisner never accepted. So he would typically write literary criticism, drama reviews for Sozialistische Monatshefte, but he tried to keep free hand. And I think that the party in Nuremberg saw that they had a magnificent opportunity to bring on one of the most accomplished journalists in the movement. Eisner is typically ranked one of the top two journalists, together with Franz Mehring, in the Social Democratic Party. For him, it was a difficult transition in some respects, in that he was a metropolitan creature. He loved Berlin, but he had had pleasant stints in Frankfurt and Marburg. So this was a chance to reestablish his credentials in a different part of the country, in Bavaria, which was, of course, in many respects antagonistic to Prussia. And Eisner found that quite congenial at that point in his career.
It's interesting how, with his move to Bavaria, he also seems to focus more upon the change that he can affect there. You describe, he never loses sight of national issues and national and, of course, international events, but he does become much more invested in what's happening in that kingdom. And this, I found it is important in terms of what you describe later on in 1918, 1919, of course.
Mm-hmm. There's no question that he believed Bavaria was less repressive than Prussia. He believed that there were opportunities there to make inroads among the rural class, to promote the socialist the Social Democratic Party in places it really had never had success, and he did that with great efficiency. He also was interested in turning his newspaper in Nuremberg into an instrument of political education on a mass scale. One of the debates in the Social Democratic Party at the time was that of the party school in Berlin, which Eisner believed was elitist. This was an institution that was backed by the party radicals, most prominently Rosa Luxemburg, Franz Mehring. They here young workers who had shown a gift for academics were brought to Berlin for half a year. They took seminars in political economy, in topics such as Marxist theory, imperialism, the nature of warfare in capitalist states. And for this 6-month period, they were indoctrinated and trained to spread that indoctrination. Eisner believed that it was really the mission of the Social Democratic Party to reach a broad mass, and so he was determined to make his newspaper an instrument of that. He did it by establishing supplements. An educational supplement where all manner of general knowledge was presented, logic, rhetoric, botany, every topic was fair game to him. He convinced the local party structure to hire a professional pedagogue who would hold lectures for workers on Sunday afternoons, who would go out into the community and speak on a variety of topics. Eisner was also extremely interested, really the leading figure in the party on international politics. The German Social Democratic Party had, in many respects, turned inward, and they were looking at what they could accomplish in Germany. Eisner was keenly aware of the threat to international peace. He saw in the first Moroccan crisis of 1905 really a prelude to an international conflagration, which occurred in less than a decade. And then once again in 1911, the second Moroccan crisis, he was utterly convinced that there would be world war. For this, he was mocked scoffed at by his comrades, and precisely those who in August 1914 rushed to the colors and basically destroyed the Second International.
So when the war did come in August 1914, how did Eisenhower himself respond to it? And how did that then shape or reshape his career trajectory?
He was at that time associate editor to Adolf Müller at the Münchner Post, the organ in the various capital. This had come about. I should backtrack a little here. This had come about because of the dissolution of his marriage in Nuremberg. He became attracted to a woman who was had a party pedigree. Her father had been the one of the linchpins in the what was called the Red Field Post, smuggling banned socialist papers back into Germany during the period of the anti-socialist laws under Bismarck, and his daughter Elsa Belli became Eisner's lover in Nuremberg. This was considered a party scandal. Eisner was wed with five children. That marriage had for some time grown stale, and Eisner sought to be free of it. He continued to support his family, but he realized that the negative publicity from that for the paper necessitated a change of venue, and he moved to Munich, and there affiliated with the Münchner Post. Under Adolf Müller, he was influenced to believe that the Tsar had plans to expand into Europe, and believed in 1914 that that Russia was the aggressor state, and that the threads to the Balkan drama were being pulled in Moscow. He initially supported Germany's entry into the First World War, but then after reading the various white papers that came out by the British government, the Belgian government, the French government, he realized that that he had been duped, and immediately began to oppose the war. For that reason, he was deprived of his political editorship at Munich, but was allowed to continue as a drama critic. He became increasingly disaffected, and eventually went over to the the opponents of the war. At the time, the Social Democratic Party as a whole backed the Burgfrieden, the civil peace that Kaiser Wilhelm had called for. Eisner opposed it and joined those who did oppose it, including many of his former adversaries, and eventually becomes the leader in Munich of the independent socialist Social Democratic Party, the splinter party that broke away from what became known as the Majority Socialists, the MSPD, the Majority Social Democratic Party, and becomes the unofficial head in the South of that splinter group.
Your chapters upon this period of Eisner's life were really fascinating. I was especially intrigued by how you described that even though he has this position as a drama critic, with that's basically what is politically possible for him, he is still infusing his writings with his criticism of the war and of the politics behind it.
Exactly. He became the leader and spokesperson for a group of radicalized veterans, men who had fought, in many cases been wounded, were sent to Munich to convalesce, and they became vehement opponents of the war, and they turned to Eisner as as their leader, as their spokesperson, and he at their request he organized weekly discussion meetings, and this group of at the beginning maybe two dozen individuals began to grow, and as it became apparent that Germany would not win the war, they attracted more and more disenchanted, radicalized students, soldiers, workers to the cause, and this really became his cadre to launch the revolution in 1918. But because of his political activity, he was imprisoned once again, this time for treason. When in January 1918, he organized a strike of munitions workers, in the attempt to force an armistice. There had been strikes in Vienna. Eisner sought to expand that to Germany as a whole. And it was quite successful in Munich. Many of the factories, many of the workers walked off the line. And Eisner and his accomplices for that, including Ernst Toller and Sarah Sonja Lersch, were arrested. They were charged with treason. They were not brought to trial, but they were held indefinitely at Stadelheim prison in Eisner's case. And he, at that point, I think, despaired that he would ever again see the light of day. As the political situation worsened for Germany, as the military situation worsened, he began to believe that he might be released at some point. And indeed, there was a release of political prisoners in October of 1918. And when Eisner came out of prison, his intent was to foment a revolution in Munich that would depose the Wittelsbach dynasty in accord with what Woodrow Wilson had demanded in his 14 points, that the United States would not negotiate with monarchs. There had to be a democratically elected government for a peace to be made. And this is at the point where this is at the end of the 100 days, where Ludendorff realizes that the situation is hopeless, that the BEF and the French are likely to storm into Germany, and peace initiatives have really gained traction. Eisner's coterie, his cadre, worked tirelessly at that point to bring about that revolution. Eisner was actually released from prison on a technicality. There was a special election in Munich. Georg von Vollmar, the longtime Social Democratic member of the Reichstag, resigned his position. Erhard Auer, who was one of Eisner's former comrades and had become a fair adversary with the party split, was one of the nominees. Eisner's contingent nominated him as the independent Social Democratic candidate for that seat. Because of a loophole in the law, if someone were nominated for a seat in the Reichstag, and they had not been convicted of a crime, they had to be released to campaign. Thus, he was released, and he had no real intention of campaigning for that seat, but rather for a revolution. Because he was neo-Kantian in his belief and non-violent, he had to convince his followers that they might well become martyrs, but by doing so, they would convince the general populace of the justice of their cause. So when in November 1918, push came to shove, Eisner's contingent really overwhelmed the majority Social Democratic contingent, and they were able to consolidate huge numbers of followers in a very brief time. And then on 6th of November, 7th of November, successfully persuade by demonstration the Bavarian king to order his car and depart the capital. There was not one drop of blood shed in that that revolution, which Eisner took great pride in. And in fact, he was never certain of its success. So the proclamation of the Republic itself was almost extemporaneous. He knew what he wanted, but he didn't realize it would come so quickly.
This was an incredibly heady period for Eisner, and yet it's one that ends just a few months later. I was wondering if you could explain what his time as premier was like, and what were some of the challenges that he faced, and what it was that ultimately led him to accept that he needed to resign.
At the end of the war, German troops were being sent home. These were men who had survived trench warfare in many cases. They were returning home without work. The British blockade had been quite successful. People in Germany were in dire straits, the civilian populace. So Eisner was worried initially about the possibility of creating a socialist republic. There was not really much industry left to nationalize. So what he concentrated on was democratic reform. He insisted on universal suffrage, for men, for women, workers who had been sent to Bavaria from North Germany were allowed to vote in the Bavarian elections. He had consolidated in large part a system of councils of Soviets, and believed that that there had to be more direct democracy than had there had been with Reichstag elections, for example. He wanted there to be a parliament, but he also wanted to have councils serve in the stead of the former upper house, the House of Lords, so to speak. And he believed that every trade, every profession should have its own council. He really did want to expand direct democracy above all other things. He wanted separation of church and state. He wanted to support education, and all of these reforms he was able to implement. He did not attempt to nationalize industry because there was not that much industry left to nationalize. Given Germany's standing, he did plan to extend socialism to agriculture, to have a more equitable distribution of land. And he had the support of the Bavarian Peasants League. Together with he realized that for his revolution to succeed and for the Republic to be consolidated, he would have to collaborate with the majority socialist party, the majority Social Democrats, who had been his adversaries recently. And remarkably, he accorded them more ministries than he did to his own party. At the same time, if you look at what was happening in Berlin, there's just there's this horrible fratricide where the majority social democratic leadership makes their alliance with the former general staff, and they turn then on the left wing of the party, the Spartacists under Rosa Luxemburg, Karl Liebknecht, and then of course in January, Luxemburg and Liebknecht are ferreted out and murdered. Eisner was trying at all costs to avoid a civil war in Bavaria, as was playing out in Berlin. He did that with success. There was no massive fighting in Munich.
You describe in the book the challenge. It wasn't just a challenge coming from the right and the Social Democrats, but as a bit of context, you had the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917. You have the fear of Bolshevism, and Eisner didn't really embrace that. So, and that's what I was fascinated by in your description, which is that he is he's pushing for these reforms that he sincerely believes in, and yet at the same time, he has these opponents who want to use those reforms to push through a revolution that is very different from the one that he intends.
Yes, exactly. There was in Munich around, for example, Erich Mühsam, there was an anarchist movement that went over to the KPD, the Communist Party, after its founding, late December, early January, 1918, 1919. And so Eisner, who believed in freedom of the press, who eschewed an official state newspaper, wanted to allow the freest possible rein to his critics, regardless of which direction. And in many cases, Erich Mühsam said that this was his undoing. He dug his own grave by not being repressive enough. But this was totally against his nature. He would have preferred to be martyred than to silence critics. So he really did, I think, everything within his power to maintain calm in the South while attempting to reforge international relations, particularly with the French. I mean, when he went to the International Socialist Conference in Bern in February 1919, he reached out to the French. He showed his great knowledge of the destruction that had occurred in France. He strove for a reunification of socialists in France and Germany. He really wanted to avoid a centrist German government dominated by Prussia, as it had been. And for that reason, opposed Hugo Preuss's a draft of the Weimar Constitution, and when he realized that in the elections that he had himself called and supported, that his independent Social Democratic Party finished far behind the majority Social Democratic Party of his adversary Erhard Auer, that it would be necessary for the government to resign and for a new government to be constituted. He used those last couple of weeks in office as a forum for his policies, for his vision. He preached it at Bern, at the at the conference of the international, and in different venues. University at Basel asked him to speak. He held an address there that is remarkable and memorable, and has appeared in a number of memoirs. And then returning to Munich, drafted his constitution at the same time he was writing his resignation, and was prepared to present the constitution to the new constituent assembly to consider. And at this point, the radical right, the Toul Society, the harbingers of the Nazi Party, were consolidating, and one of their devotees, a man who had actually been deprived admission to the Toul Society because of his partially Jewish heritage, his mother was Jewish, Anton Arco Al-Falei, young Catholic aristocrat, determined that Eisner had to be assassinated. And so Eisner was warned repeatedly by different friends and also by some adversaries that he faced assassination. He never flinched from that. His remark was, "They can only shoot me once." That did indeed happen when he was actually en route to the Landtag to tender his government's resignation.
His assassination is in some ways a harbinger for what Germany is going to experience over the next two decades. You describe in your final chapter, when you talk about the legacy, the fate of so many people who followed him. His assassination in some ways presages Matthias's, Ebert's, and of course, you know, later on, the visceral reaction of the radical right, as you've already alluded to, is a portent for the rise of the Nazis in the 1930s. And yet when he is finishing that period of his premiership, you write that he seems to be very content with what he has left behind. What was his legacy for Bavaria and for the wider world?
Well, what he thought his legacy was the democratic reform of the monarchical structure, that he was ushering in really modernity, that the people themselves would be sovereign and have their choice. This, of course, did not come to pass. It was not meant to be. I speak some about the failed revolution and the stillborn democracy of Weimar Republic. The Eisner believed that there would be elections, and eventually that the people themselves would realize how they had been exploited by their past rulers. They would be more accepting of democracy, and eventually it would triumph. If you want to look at a single figure who illustrates this, I would say look at Thomas Mann. Thomas Mann was initially extremely critical of Eisner's government. He had been a monarchist. He had supported the First World War. And then during that period of Weimar Germany, when he saw the Nazi rise to power, he became a reluctant Democrat and, of course, had to flee to the U.S., spend his time here in exile, but then became eventually a committed Democrat. I think that this was the mentality that Eisner had sought to foster in the populace as a whole. He believed in the triumph of socialism. He believed in social justice, which he equated with socialism. And this was, of course, a bone of contention with the historical materialists, with the economic determinists. His legacy, I think, is that his democratic republic was the last best chance to preclude Adolf Hitler and the Nazi rise to power. And the failure of Eisner's government and Hitler's rise to power constitute, I think, two of the great tragedies of the 20th century.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
The next project is It is an article on Brecht's prologue to the Caucasian Chalk Circle and the political purpose of that prologue.
Sounds like a very interesting article. Well, thank you very much for taking some time away from your work to speak with us, Al. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Mark, thank you so much. And thanks to the New Books Network.
It was our pleasure.